starting our favorite show. Oh, you like good music. That sweet soul music.
Thank you, Lord. Just let me hear some of that rock and roll music. Scott Edward Phelps.
America's favorite old fart.
His past is a mystery, but his work is already a legend.
Dave Simmons.
He's very fussy about his drums. They loom large in his legend.
Chicks dig me because I rarely wear underwear.
Two honest, intelligent men.
Two guys who know tunes. Talking tunes.
Conversation like a television set on honeymoon. Unnecessary.
Now, here comes the music. If you wanna dance
with me. The audio files. If you wanna dance
with me. That's right, but when it comes to dancing, we make it a habit to be the ones who lead.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, we do. I'm Scott Edward Phelps.
And I'm Dave Simmons.
And we're the audio files. Kicking it off.
The Beatles.
Save the date, October 28th, at this writing, that's in about 7-8 days, about a week from now. And if you're listening to this after October 28th, 2022, then hey, what I just said is absolutely academic.
Welcome to the past.
There it is. Oh, that's a head ringer. That's Paul McCartney on the bass, and Paul McCartney on lead guitar.
Yes.
And Paul McCartney sweeping up the studio.
All Paul, all the time.
All the time. From the classic, iconic 7th. Studio album recorded in 1966 by the Beatles, Revolver. And the reason I said save the date is because October 28th is the date that the new reissue Super Turbo package, the
expanded box set,
third or fourth or fifth, I don't know how many there are so far, but this is the latest in the series, put together by Giles Martin, who is George Martin's son. He still is George Martin's son. And I think it's the one, this time it comes around, it's like a 78 CDs, 12 Blu-rays, 8-track tape, about 6 of those, and I think there's some VHS something in there, I don't know what else. And it's a low, low price of $7,362.
Yes. The really cool thing is I think it includes the mono mix, so you can actually hear the record as it came out in 1966.
You know, I dig that, you dig that, but I wonder how many people... And this was true when the anthology first came out, what now, 30 years ago, hell. It's archive stuff.
Right, right.
90% of it, isn't it? I mean, and I'm not putting it down. I'm just being my Virgo Vulcan, cool appraising eye kind of guy. And I'm thinking, it amuses me. That's not the word. It intrigues me, the number of people who aren't necessarily musicians or professionals in any way, shape, or form, spending the amount of money, because these things are pretty expensive.
I think this is right up there, close to $300.
Yeah, and that was like half of what I paid for my first car. But not this year, of course. But you know what I'm saying? And
yeah.
So there's that. Case in point, we knew, because we've been around forever and we know all this useless stuff, that Paul McCartney played the lead guitar solo on Taxman.
On Taxman, yeah.
Because he wasn't happy with what George was doing.
He wasn't happy with what George was doing on George's song.
Well, you know, the longer we live and the more we find out about Paul McCartney, the more we find out that, and the man is gifted. There's no question about that.
Yes.
But you have to kind of write off a lot of what the dramatic media articles write about, you know, how they...
Let's call him a taskmaster.
Yeah.
That would probably describe him the best.
Yeah. He's the guy, and truth be told, I liken him to Sheldon Cooper.
Yes. Yeah.
He's got to be in charge. He's got to be the one that's right. We got to do it his way, and it's not his way or the highway.
Yeah. Laser focus. Yeah.
Yeah. But what is interesting about the Revolver package, and like Dave talked about all the other packages, is some of the things, if you're interested in hearing that kind of stuff, like, hey, what? Here's a catchphrase. You say you want a evolution? I got applause now. We don't have a rim shot anymore. Thank you. Thank you very much. So when you're talking about it, yeah, thank you. Thanks a lot, really, seriously. Okay. Yeah, have a seat. We've only got an hour and a half. There you go. Here's an example. Dave sent me over this one and said, hey, here's an example. And I went, yeah, you're right. The song She Said is on the album Revolver, as everybody knows, who knows Revolver. And I did a little edit for time on this. Here's what you're going to hear. You're going to hear about 10 seconds of, I'm sure was probably the very first idea.
It was his demo, yeah.
That he had. Mm-hmm. Well, this is, yeah, but I'm saying the first just, hey, I got this idea for this song, which, by the way, as the urban legend has it, was inspired by John Lennon went to a, the guys went to a party and Peter Fonda was there.
And yeah.
And he was, they were all tripping.
But it was a girl that kept coming up to them saying that.
It wasn't, see, now the urban legend says it was Peter Fonda.
Yeah, it's not, it wasn't Peter Fonda.
Okay, so the girl kept coming up and saying,
I know what it's like to be dead.
There you go.
Yeah.
Now, I used to say that, but that had to do with ex-wives.
Right. Right?
That's
right.
An entirely different story. Anyway, so that's one of the taglines in the song. So John sits down with a guitar, and it's real rough and raw. And this is, well, alright, here's what you're going to hear. You'll hear about 10 seconds of what we assume was like the very beginning idea that he had. Then with no explanation, it just jumps. And when it does that, you're going to realize that what he did was he had an idea to change the groove a little bit. Okay, just to give you an idea how this works. It's kind of cool.
He said, I know what it's like to be dead. I said, he said, I know what it's like to be dead. I know what it's like to be sad.
The first part of it, when he first had the little run through there, it sounded like it could very easily have fallen into a country.
Yes.
A country,
yeah, it had a twang to it.
Like a little I've just seen a face.
Mm-hmm.
She said, I know what it's like to be dead. But that's how songs are written, kids. I've written songs. Dave's written songs.
Yes.
We've been published and recorded.
Yes, we have.
And we know what the hell we're talking about. And of course, just for the sake of AB contrast, those who know the song know that this is how it ended up. Now, here's the thing. This gets talked about in musical journals and magazines and examinations by critics and stuff like that, but not in the everyday environment of like what we're doing here. You're the world-class percussionist drummer guy in the band, this band.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me a little bit about Ringo's performance on that song.
Oh, on that song? Oh, God. It's phenomenal, and I can honestly tell you, I really probably don't think that was Ringo's idea. Ringo's more of a four on the floor, straight beat. This has kind of a syncopated off rhythm to it.
So another case of McCartney saying, here we go. But Ringo was able
Ringo's to- playing it. Yeah, that's sure. Definitely Ringo's playing. You can tell Ringo washes the hi-hat a lot. Mm-hmm. When I say wash it, he doesn't close it completely.
Okay.
You very rarely hear the
right.
You know what I mean? The click. It's always a washy hi-hat sound. So you know that's Ringo.
So it's
Ringo.
More of a baby cymbal sound than a hi-hat sound.
You know that that's Ringo. But Paul McCartney probably, because the drums are locked right to the bass.
Right.
So McCartney was probably like, here's the bass line. Why don't you do this? I wasn't there, but I can see that happening.
Sure. Well, that happened a lot from what we know historically. You know,
so, but that's an... Dude, Ringo's so underrated. Everybody puts Ringo down. Ringo is so underrated.
I read an article, or it wasn't an article, it was part of a book that I read written by a guy named Mark Lewison, who is another Beatle historian who's written tons of stuff through the years and knows his stuff because he interviewed the guys over the years and all that. And he said, and this is, the book is available, I'm sure, somewhere. It's called The Beatles Recording Sessions. And in that, he's talking about, I remember distinctly, he said that he, in the course of doing his research for the book, had the opportunity to listen to all of the source tapes, meaning all of the original recordings of the tracks and everything from the get-go, hours and hours and hours and hours of stuff. And he said the one thing that was constant
Ringo.
In all of it was Ringo.
Yep.
Never, his timing was, it was almost scary because there was no such thing as a click track or anything.
There was
like
no
that
clicks.
That,
you know, there were metronomes, but they weren't set
to
use in a studio situation. You can hear a metronome on Blackbird.
Sure.
McCartney
I thought that was George.
No,
they only allowed him to do certain things. So I thought,
McCartney left that in Blackbird, the song off of the White Album.
Okay.
But, you know, with a full band playing, you're not going to hear that.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Well, obviously the licks, are innovative, mm-hmm. especially for the time. We're talking, what, 1965?
65 and everybody's
into 1966. Yeah. Okay. All right. So
well, the funny thing is, I listened to an interview with, I wanted to get Giles Martin's take on this.
Yeah.
I listened to an interview with him and this is word for word what he said. He said, listening to the playback tapes, mm-hmm. the thing that struck him was everyone's acceptance of everyone's ideas. Mm. So if Harrison would say, look, I got a guitar riff, they're like, okay, yeah, mm-hmm. let's hear it. Mm. McCartney would say this, you know, Ringo would do a fill. They'd be like, oh, that's cool. Let's do that. Mm. It wasn't like one person directing. Everybody was shooting ideas.
At least at that point.
At that point in time.
In the history of things. Mm-hmm. It may have gotten a little more. Yeah. Paul runs things.
I think at the point where Lennon shut down, I think that was after Sergeant Pepper.
Well, that's when Yoko came along, and he was
he wasn't as interested in the Beatles as he had been initially, because it was John's band when it started.
Well, they grew up too.
Yeah,
you know, they were 17 and 18 when they started mm-hmm. out together.
Harrison might have even been 16.
Yeah, that's interesting, and that right there, and it's not talked about much because it's kind of scholarly and a little bit dusty, but that's an interesting point when you're talking about the Beatles and the success of their songs, and I think it has a lot to do with why the stuff is timeless and is still as listenable and enjoyable, because they did contribute multiple ideas.
Right.
They didn't, there was no such thing as
multiple influences.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly. And there was no such thing as a Beatles song. If you pick certain bands, a lot of bands, even nowadays, especially nowadays because of sampling and all that, but if you go back to the 60s and 70s and even into the 80s, there's a certain style of song that a band has where you think it's the joke almost becomes, oh, look, this band has their song out again.
Yeah.
Because it's there it is. But every album that the Beatles did was this,
different from the last. Yeah.
And this combination of all the various styles. And this is beginning to sound like a Beatles love.
Well, actually, the album right before Revolver was the album that Rubber Soul was the album where Harrison picked up a sitar and started becoming interested in Indian music. And I think by the time Revolver came out, he had already started taking lessons from Ravi Shankar.
If you like the tuning, we hope you like the playing more.
Check out Bangladesh. That's a fun thing.
So I think he had already started, you know, he grabbed a sitar on Norwegian Wood and figured out the notes.
Have you ever heard the anthology, the original tracks of Norwegian Wood, and how god awful it is because he fills every hole with that damn sitar? Yeah. And that again, see, we could do 2 hours on the Beatles, but it was that kind of thing where they roughed it out, and some of those early takes sound like. But they knew how to pull out and put in and.
Well, it was either them self-editing or George Martin editing.
Or a contribution of the two.
Or a combination of the both.
All right, here's another example. On Revolver, the iconic, I think it's fair to call it, song, Eleanor Rigby. Where, you're asking, I'm sure, at this point, did Eleanor Rigby come from? Well, let's go to the source and listen to what the composer, or at least one of the main composers, had to say.
Eleanor Rigby is based on an old lady that I got to know very well. I don't even know how I first met Eleanor Rigby, but I would go around to her house, and not just once or twice, I found out that she lived on her own, so I'd go around there and just chat. Later, I would offer to go and get her shopping. She'd give me a list, and I'd bring the stuff back, and we'd sit in her kitchen. Just hearing her stories enriched my soul and influenced the songs I would later write. She may actually have started with a quite different name, Daisy Hawkins. I can see that Hawkins is quite nice, but it wasn't right.
And I'd just like to say that although I've never met him personally, he doesn't talk like that. He's actually reading. That's from the audiobook.
The audiobook,
of his thing called Lyrics, mm-hmm. which is his explanation of each and every of the songs. All right, so Eleanor Rigby, he gives you the inspiration for Whence It Comes. And just like John, he sits down with a guitar in some room that has no acoustics and nothing else going on. Maybe his bathtub, who knows. And he does a little rough to keep. I called them work tapes.
Yeah.
Before they became demos. This is Eleanor Rigby's work tape.
All the lonely people, where do they all belong? Where do they all belong?
obviously proof that the original working title of the song was Where Do They All Belong? Do They All? All right, so Paul has this working idea. He brings it in. They toss the ideas around. There is some debate all these years still about who contributed the most. And ultimately,
it's Lennon's Playboy interviews, which oddly enough were the last interviews of his life. They were taken like a couple of days before he was was murdered.
Right.
He said that McCartney came in with the chorus and threw that in the lap of him and George and said, we need some verses. So I don't know if that's true or not, or if that's Lennon maybe being cheeky towards Paul.
Well, it just occurs to me, you're thinking to yourself, Lennon gives this interview where he basically says, yeah, that's all poppycock. I ever contributed most of the Eleanor Rigby. And then several days later, just several days later, John Lennon.
He was a hit.
Oh, we're going to have to.
So are you insinuating Paul McCartney had John Lennon killed?
No, not at all. And those who have not been on Uranus know I'm talking about the planet for the last 60 years. You've heard how the demo eventually evolved. Look at all the lovely people. Eleanor Rigby died in the church and was buried along with her name. That's from an album that I produced. It's called Beatles Songs in 60 Seconds or Less, just to give you the taste of the whole thing.
The crazy thing about a lot of the Beatles songs, when George Martin flexed his muscles, you know, his composing muscles, you know, it's phenomenal. It's just phenomenal.
You know what these guys were? I mean, collectively, and I think in hindsight of it, even at the time it was recognized, but I've never heard it said this way necessarily, and there's talent there that defies description, but in addition to that, they were the perfect storm.
Yes.
In every way.
Mm-hmm.
The four of them and their personalities, the four of them and their various musical chops, George Martin's contribution and the engineer's contributions
Brian
to their
Epstein's
product,
management.
Brian Epstein's management for as long as it lasted, which was briefly. But in the studio, and I mentioned this to you the other day, I'm still amazed now, even after all these years, because I've long ago lost my Beatle hysteria and have just, although they're my guys, I can listen to their work pretty objectively. And given the period in which those things were recorded, the sonic quality of those records, as opposed to a lot of the stuff or most of the stuff that was being produced and released back in 1965, is phenomenal. And that I write off in large measure to George Martin.
That was a four-track machine.
Yeah. I mean, you and I have
We've worked on four-track machines, and we've bounced stuff around like he did, but nothing to the extent that George Martin had to bounce.
It's the musical equivalent of when Roger Ebert wrote a review of the movie Apollo 13, and he was talking, and Apollo 13 took place in April of 1970, and Ebert's opening comment was pretty witty. He said, just to show you how the technology has advanced, he said, these three guys took off to the moon in a craft whose computer wasn't as advanced as the one that I'm writing this review on now. And that's what these guys were all about at the time. Real quickly, Bruce Spicer is a New Orleans tax attorney. In the daytime, and at nighttime, when he ain't working for the mob laundering money, he's a Beatle historian, and he's written about a dozen books, and a new one is coming that kind of addresses the period we've been talking about, essentially, from Rubber Soul to Revolver to Sgt. Pepper. And I want to include this clip real quick, because you and I have talked about Rubber Soul and Revolver being Pepper's cool. Pepper is all the things that it is. For me, the turnaround for these guys was Rubber Soul.
Rubber Soul, and yeah.
Now, you got to remember, for context's sake, they were my generation more than Dave's, per se, just by the 15 or so years difference between us. But I was 14 in 1965. So I got the Beatle thing, the Ed Sullivan thing, when I was a 12-year-old kid. Got that Silvertone guitar. It was, yeah, 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 I want to hold your hand. And then, boom, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there's I've Just Seen a Face, Norwegian Wood, with George's sitar curtailed.
They were moving into that direction with
Beatles for Sale.
Babies in Black.
Right.
You know what I mean? So they went from He Loves You, She Loves You, Yeah, and I Love Her. They went from all that to
Yeah, it was a smoother transition. Yeah. It wasn't quite as much of a jump as I made it sound like.
Right, right.
Now.
Yeah, but they were heading in that direction.
Yeah, but even George Harrison said in an interview that I read a long time ago that he, for him, and he was there, so you probably know, that Rubber Soul and Revolver for him were like part one and part two of the same album.
Yes.
Yeah. Pepper was an entirely different story. Well, you're a Revolver guy. I am too, but me not so much. I'm a Rubber Soul guy, et cetera, et cetera. But I found it interesting because this is what author, historian Mr. Spicer has to say about the whole thing.
When you talk about the greatest Beatle albums, and everyone, of course, has to mention Sgt. Pepper. I don't think Sgt. Pepper is the best Beatles album. I think it's the most important because, you know, it revolutionized the way people thought about albums. But Revolver was a real breakthrough, and that was the album where the Beatles truly learned to use the studio as an instrument itself, all the unique sounds they were getting. And as great an album as Revolver is, think of how much better it would have been had it included Paperback Writer and Rain.
That's true.
The last little moment there kind of off put me a little, and not to be critical, it's we agree to disagree. That's a subjective kind of thing. Paperback Writer and Rain as a single was outstanding, and I'm talking as the kid who was 15 and we went into the record store and picked that up.
Well, we haven't even pointed this out. The Beatles didn't put their singles on albums back then.
No.
So, I mean,
right, and cranked out two albums a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the first year, they cranked out like 16 albums, but that was just compilations. That's the other thing that it was all about. But so anyway, Revolver stands as all I could think of, and I'm going to put the sound clip in next week to use it as a thing when I need like a little something like. You know, it's a wonder, and it applies to the White Album, but I think it holds true for what the guy just said about Paperback Writer and Rain possibly being making Revolver better, blah, blah, blah. Paul McCartney interviewed years ago, I think it was from the anthology, but I've got the audio clip somewhere, but he's talking about the White Album, and the interviewer asked this inane question about, well, what do you say to people who say that it shouldn't have been two records, it was too many songs, it should have been tailored down? Even George Martin kind of said maybe we could have done a tighter album, et cetera. And I'm paraphrasing what McCartney said, except for the punchline. In his wonderful Paul accent, he said, well, I'm not much for second-guessing what we did and how it was. We put it together at the time it worked. And his quote was, it's great, it's sold, it's the bloody Beatles White Album, shut up. So it's kind of like that with that.
Well,
just let me hear some of that rock and roll music. Any old way you choose it. It's got a backbeat, you can't lose it. Any old time you use it. It's gotta be rock and roll music. If you wanna dance with me. If you wanna dance with me.
Well, there's an interesting dovetail segue out of nowhere.
Yes.
That'll come up in just a second when I explain that. The first time I ever heard rock and roll music, the Chuck Berry song, and that was Chuck Berry, the guy who wrote the song.
Was the Beatles.
Was the Beatles version of rock and roll music. You were about to add something else, though, before we jumped in there.
Oh, well, I just wanted to tag the end of that segment. Giles Martin said something at the end of his interview that was profound. He said, music doesn't get old. We just get old around music. And I thought that was very fitting. I mean, you know, how many years is it? 50 years since Revolver? Or?
Oh, yeah, 56 years this year.
56 years, yeah. And they're reissuing it, and it will sell as like hotcakes.
And I say and hold to firm what I said before, because it was the perfect storm, and because it had all of those elements and still does. That's the way they put them together.
Well, I got a good story for the Chuck Berry. You know, by the way, his birthday would have been the 18th.
You said what? You have a story?
I have a story.
Here's a story.
Oh, you hit me with that one. I wasn't expecting it. So
this is a high-class operation, pal.
At the Hall of Fame induction last week, I got the privilege of all the acts that were there. I was able to play the finale. And I said, well, what song are we playing in the finale? And they said, rock and roll music, Chuck Berry. And I was like, no, we're playing the Beatles version. And he was like, well, we're doing Chuck Berry's version. I was like, I'm driving this truck. We're playing the Beatles version, which is faster.
Don't let him give you any crap, man. Just got to do what you got to do.
You know, so no, we ended up playing
the
that.
The Beatles version is,
better is a subjective word. It's more energetic.
It's got more energy and
solid. Of course, it's four guys and a great producer besides just.
And that conversation wasn't a conversation I had with them. That was a conversation in my head. I was like, no, we're playing the Beatles version.
Well, and this was the great thing about these guys like Chuck Berry, Little Richard, again, being the age I was at the time, 13, 14, 15, I didn't know. And again, you have to live in the time of the times. Way back when. There was no downloading. There was no wide exposure. We had a transistor radio where we could listen to our favorite radio station, and we were subject to whatever the radio station played. And there were record stores such as they were. That was it.
And the black artists weren't getting the airplay that the white artists were. So.
The biggest hit in 1959 or 60 was Tutti Frutti. Ah, Rudy. But it was Pat Boone.
Yes.
Not Little Richard, because black guys, anyway. What I started when that threw, and we put that together there a minute ago. The segue into this is this. When I was doing morning radio, every morning we did birthdays. I hated it. And I'll tell you why. Radio consultants will tell you people love to have morning shows and sometimes afternoon drive, but mostly morning shows, do birthdays.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody loves that because everybody has a birthday. It's a wonderful universal thing. And I used to have discussions with consultant friends of mine and contest with consultants I didn't care too much for. And I know that they have their pie charts and bar graphs, but I don't care. Let me tell you who likes birthday segments on morning radio shows. Now, admittedly, this is civilian birthdays, not famous people's birthdays.
Right.
Because there's like five people who care. One is the person who's getting to hear their name on the radio. Two is the person whose name is being called out on the radio for having a birthday. And three is, say, 3 to 5 people in the family who are hearing or will hear later in some fashion that particular thing. Right. Everybody else is reaching for the channel changing knob when it comes to birthdays. So I said, first of all, with our little musical format genre here, we're not going to do any civilian birthdays. If you're poised to call in or email us and say, ask us to dedicate,
I would like to dedicate rock and roll music to my cousin Bird.
Unless you're very funny behind that, that ain't going to happen. But I've discovered through the years, and what I did, because I always end up doing things my way, I'm kind of like Paul McCartney. I just said, no, we're not going to do it this way. We're going to do it my way. I did celebrity birthdays on a given day, but we did it in a way where we had a little fun with it. And this is going to be, I hope, a little fun, because we won't spend an inordinate amount of time with it. But you had asked to mentioned Chuck Berry, and I thought, sure, let's do birthday segment and talk about a dead guy right off the bat. That's always a way to
say it. Well, it's had a great upper.
I know. 96, he would have been.
He would have been, yes.
This year. And I appreciate that. And remember the name, or remember the age, 96. In a few minutes, that's going to have more relativity than you can stand in terms of satire. He would have been 96. I got a quick list here of those I call... And actually, we may throw this in down the road a few shows from now. One of the segments that I did, and occasionally still do on the podcasts when I'm doing live podcast oldies stuff, instead of it being, hey, let's do birthdays, I do my own little twisted version of it because most of the people that I mention are still living. And the segment is called Not to Worry. Turns out they're not dead after all because they reach these ages where, oh my heavens, Justin Hayward of the Moody Blues, for example, one of the founding members. Dude is 76 years old this week. Cliff Richard. You know who Cliff Richard was? He influenced the Beatles. He's 82, which is interesting because he was already an established star of some years in England when the Beatles were listening to him, and he's the same age as Ringo and the age John would have been if John was alive. So it's not like he'd been around for 5 or 6 more years than they have. I found that kind of interesting. And you may or may not remember Cliff from a song. He had a hit in the 80s. Call We Don't Talk Anymore.
Yes.
It's so funny. Yep. Yep. Yeah, yep. That's Sir Cliff Richard. Daryl Hall of Hall & Oates, my favorite breakfast cereal. He's also 76.
I love Daryl. I've seen that. They are one of the best live bands, hands down.
They cook.
Musically, yes.
Oatmeal cooks. Clever. Richard Carpenter is 76. Karen died like 50 years ago, but Richard's still out there, and that dude was weird. I came across, it's on YouTube if you want to go looking for it, a little tiny video clip of an appearance they did on a TV variety show in like 1969, I want to say, when they were in college. Karen was on the drums, Richard was on the electric piano, and they had a stand-up bass player, and that was the group, and they called themselves the Dick Carpenter Trio.
Oh, wow.
And they were introduced as the Dick Carpenter Trio.
I tell you what, she was a phenomenal drummer.
And she drummed and sang. She was still the lead vocalist. They weren't doing all that
Carpenter stuff. She's known for her voice, but her drumming, I mean, she was an above average drummer.
But anybody that wants to contemplate how unfair and strange life may be, Karen's gone and Richard's not. So do with that what you will. Barry Maguire. Name ring a bell?
Show Me the Money guy. Oh, that was Jerry Maguire. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. What do we think about that, Kat? No, it's okay. Barry Maguire had a very upbeat, happy tempo, kind of a 59th Street Bridge groovy song in the 60s called Eve of Destruction.
You may not remember. I didn't know that was Barry
Maguire. It's Barry Maguire. And what was it?
Happy. That's right. Up-tempo. Snappy.
No, it really wasn't. It was gloom and doom. But it's very timely today. If you want to give it a listen. He was a member of the New Christy Minstrels, the folk group, before he became the single star. He's 87. He's still around. Sam Moore, Sam and Dave. Hold on, I'm coming. Yep. And he's 87. Gary Puckett.
Gary Puckett, the Union Gap.
And those guys, he's 80 this week. So more power to you. They got away with a lot of crap back in the day. If you objected, let's do like a whole half a show on that one of these days. Think just for a second. Woman, woman, have you got cheating on your mind? Young girl, get out of my mind.
Yes.
Lady, willpower, it's now or never, give your heart to me. This was a lot of stalking and abuse and crap going on of a kinky, weird.
Yeah. Gary Puckett. Saying.
But happy birthday, Gary. Wendy Wilson. Who is she?
Dave's
pop quiz. Wendy Wilson.
What was Anna Nancy Wilson and Hart? Wendy Wilson.
Well, she's also a famous sister. Wendy is.
Of the Wilson sisters, obviously.
That's it. I'll give you a hint. Carney Wilson.
Oh, yes.
Wendy's the other one.
Yeah, Bri Wilson's daughters.
Right. Yeah. Who teamed up with China Phillips and created Wilson Phillips. Are you ready for a little gray hair pop? Get ready for this one. Little Wendy Wilson, the quiet one there. She's 53 years old.
Yeah, I can see that.
Sean Lennon, if this don't pop your hair, and I'm talking about gray colors, Sean Lennon is 47 this week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because he was born on
his dad's
birthday.
Yep.
Yeah, in 1975. He is now, this is like Hallmark card time, and not to get too schlocky, but he has now lived, with this birthday, he has now lived 7 years longer than his father lived in his entire life.
Mm-hmm.
Just call me Debbie Downer. Paul Simon's 81.
Yeah.
And these guys are still making music and still doing it good. And Sammy Hagar, I don't know why I threw this in except say 71.
Dude, Sammy is a
75.
He's a miracle.
He jumps
around like he's 15 years old.
Well, I think he and Keith Richard have the same vitamin regimen or something's going on.
Have you seen the meme that has him, a picture of him and a picture of Bill Clinton? And it said Sammy Hagar was on the road for years doing drugs as a rock star, and Bill lived with Hillary.
So let that be a lesson to you kids as you raise your kids, make sure that they hang out with Sammy Hagar and that they don't go hitting on Hillary Clinton.
There you go.
Because that'll get them in trouble every time. And here's a cool birthday for somebody who's actually living and is somewhere beneath 60 years of age. Oh, by golly, where's the button? Yep. Everybody's favorite Corona beer guy and Martha Stewart's BFF, it's the Snoopster.
When the pimp's in the crib, ma, drop it like it's hot. Drop it like it's hot. Drop it like it's hot. When the pigs try to get at you, park it like it's hot. Park it like it's hot. Park it like it's hot. And if a get an attitude, pop it like it's hot.
Let me tell you, I love Snoop Dogg.
I like Snoop too, but I absolutely love.
But
I have to confess something. I will confess this to you. And I know you're a percussionist, a drummer, rhythm is your thing.
Snoop.
And I love that. That was cool. I've never been a fan of that particular genre of music. And I know this is on me. It has to do with my ADD, OCD, HBO, all that stuff that I got churning around in me. It's all about the groove, and I get it.
Mm-hmm.
But I've said for years, even as a musician, when I was writing material, I would say, that's fine, but a real deep groove is a rut. And at some point, all I hear is the audio equivalent of water dripping on my forehead. I'm not a dancer. I don't enjoy it. I don't have that rhythm, and I don't have an appreciation for that. Well, it just seems repetitious and monotonous to me.
I tell you, we have one of these days, we'll do a whole show on rap, and I'll introduce you to, like, Public Enemy and the musicality of the, what they're doing and
stuff.
Well,
I'm familiar with them, basically. I'd be happy to do an in-depth analysis, and you can explain to me why I'm wrong.
But. Yeah. Snoop, you know, somehow he went from a gangster, you know, with the of the Blood and Crip level, mm-hmm. to being Martha Stewart's best friend.
Yeah.
And he did it seamlessly.
Mm-hmm.
And he acts, he's funny in whatever he's in acting wise.
He's a savvy guy.
Yeah, I tell you what, he's a businessman.
The same thing can be, there's a few people in the rock world, the pop world of to which this applies. Snoop is one. Madonna's another. Like her, hate her, be disgusted by her, do whatever you want to do, but she doesn't accomplish what she has accomplished by being unsavvy about how to do it in the business world.
Always reinventing themselves.
And you know who does it in a more delightful way, but it's the same principle? Dolly.
Yes. Oh, she's the queen of it.
Knows exactly what they're doing, stepwise and marketing wise and all the rest of that. So anyway, that's new music from Snoop, by the way.
No, it's not new.
Is it not?
No, that's been out probably 10 years.
Okay. It's new in the last 10 years.
Yes. Well, Snoop, the thing that was funny is when you see Snoop and Martha Stewart together, now, which one would you think is a felon?
Yeah. Of course.
That's you know, that's.
And if you check out the Comedy Central roasts and you happen to catch one where Snoop and or Martha are guesting there, you will be delightfully entertained because they go to town on that kind of stuff. But you're right.
Yeah, it's crazy. But happy birthday, Snoop, the 20th.
It bashes stereotypes.
But yeah, ever when he came out with Dr. Dre on The Chronic, it was The Chronic is the album.
All right. I misspoke when I said it was new. And what happened was my brain wires got crossed because coming up in a minute, we're going to talk about a couple of new pieces of music, I won't tell you who at this point, but my Snoop. Oh, I meant to tell, I did make a note for myself. For those of you who are hip to Snoop Doggy, here's the cheesy punchline of the week. Snoop never met a doobie he didn't like.
That is true.
And I'm not talking about Michael McDonald. You know what I'm saying? All right. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much. All right. So, thank you. Really. No kidding. I got a show today. Please sit down. This is getting to be embarrassing. I saved the last birthday for last because to me, this is the big finish. This woman, you know, we toss words around like legend, icon, those kinds of words. She's 63 this week, still making music, still in the public eye, groundbreaking, and the history of her career. I mean, the kind of influence that she's had on the music industry. I've got a brief little kind of together thing here, runs all 60 seconds, and I'll semi-narrate it for you. The first song that she did that really broke through for her and got us her attention, or got her us attention, our attention, help me with the grammar. It was actually a redo, a reboot, a reimagining, if you will, back in the late 70s when she was pretty young, of what had been an old country song, believe it or not. That's right.
Paper roses, paper roses.
That's right. I'm talking about Marie Osmond.
Oh, like the river, it just keeps on going.
And then the 80s, she kicked it. And then the landmark duet with Dan Seals. I'm telling you, she affected me like Beatles, fine. Marie, and this is the song right here. Talk about your Sergeant Pepper. Come on, man.
I'm a little bit country.
I'm a little bit rock and roll.
I'm a little bit of Memphis and Nashville.
With a little bit of Motown in my soul.
We're a little bit country.
I'm going to ask you to kill me now. Please kill me.
Actually, when I was a kid, I used to watch that variety show that they had.
It was cute.
It was cute. And
when
and
you're like
was,
six.
Well, she was cute. Yeah, everybody my age had a crush on her.
We did okay with her, too.
You know,
I was only half kidding when I said she changed rock and roll. She's another one of those, though.
she's still, in, you know, of course, Jenny Craig has helped and all those other things that she does, but she knows exactly how to market herself.
Oh, yeah.
And that was one of the, I just wanted to pull a fast one. And here's one I think you'll like. When I went to get, because I was familiar with the, most people aren't, of course, with the duet that she did with Dan Seals back in the 80s called Meet Me in Montana. It was done in Nashville, and a couple of friends of mine were involved in producing and writing that song. And they made a few bucks. But it was Marie and Dan Seals singing Meet Me in Montana. All right? We're not talking about Hey Jude here. When I went to YouTube to get the video to distill down the piece to use for the little demo just now, every YouTube, just like everything else on the planet now, has a little comment thread below it.
Right.
The very first comment below the Meet Me in Montana with Dan Seals and Marie Osmond video was from a guy, and aptly named, and he named himself, so I'm not slamming a guy or a gal, Knucklehead 22222. And this is what Knucklehead 22222 had to say about Meet Me in Montana with Dan Seals and Marie Osmond. And I quote, "One of the best songs ever written or performed. Correct me if I'm wrong." Well, Knucklehead 2222, on behalf of the audiophiles, you're wrong.
Yes, yes.
All right. You're listening to The Audiophiles.
Did I just learn something new and have fun doing it? What? All right.
What's up?
All right, in the category of what's new, it's not the Snoop Dogg song that you just heard a few minutes ago, but there is a piece. Dave sent this over to me, and I had seen a little blurb on it in the morning show prep online websites, which I have access to now because I still have the passwords, but don't tell anybody because I'm not supposed to have that. And here's a little excerpt of the what, and then we'll tell you the who if you don't recognize it.
So loud and clear, your life is your own, you're in charge of yourself, master of your own, in the end, you have to face it all.
Paul McCartney on lead. Well, he told the guy how to play it, and he just couldn't pull it off. So. All right, so we didn't do the lottery to guess who that is. Who in the world who are fans of these guys doesn't know who that is? But go ahead and tell them who it is.
That's Queen.
Of course it is.
Actually, they've released a previously unreleased song that has Freddie Mercury's, one of the last vocals he did before he passed in 91. Mm-hmm. And it also marks the first time since 96 or 97 that John Deacon, the original bass player, played with them. So it's all four members on a track since 1997. That's the first time.
Is that the only how many things? Is it just this song?
Just this one song. I don't know what's left. That's the thing with these artists, like, you know, these artists that have died. Like, they're always finding new Jimi Hendrix tapes and live concerts and stuff that they did not even know existed. So this isn't to say that this is the last thing that's going to come out, but they said this was all that they had.
I'll tell you something about this song too. I listened to the whole thing, obviously. And by the way, this is a real quick insert parenthetical, something that we'll be doing each and every week when you go to download the podcast at your various places, wherever you go. And listening to this program, you may as well know that we're just kicking this off, so it may take about a week, two, three, I don't know yet, to show up on various other platforms besides the home platform, which is at podomatic.com. But you can and will be able to also find the show at my website, which is sepradionetwork.com, and that's one word, all lowercase, SEP Radio Network. And we're going to have something that will be – I decided – we talked about – tacking it on the end of the program here, but I thought, well, maybe folks would like to have the option to do or not do that, or do or not do this. So there's going to be another accompanying program, but there's no chit-chat, there's no nothing, there's just the music, and we're calling it cleverly. Ready for this? We're the Audiophiles. That's the name of this show. The Audio Files. And what the files will be each week will simply be in order that we share them from excerpts, the complete versions of all the songs that we play on the show. So if you've never heard the entire version of Eleanor Rigby, you know, where the hell you been. But in that case, there, right. there it will be. This serves two purposes. It allows us to be of service to musical folks who love the songs and would like to hear them all one reason or another. It also gets us off the hook when somebody says, hey, how come you only played 7 seconds of that song? And that's our way of saying, hey, get off our case.
Yes.
We love you, but get off our case.
Yes.
That song right there, though, real quick, and I know it wasn't and it could never be, but, and especially it hit me at the chorus because of the minor thing it did. It sounded like a James Bond theme.
Yes.
Sound like an Adele, and Sam
face
Smith.
Face It Alone. I almost wonder if they didn't submit it for a Bond movie. Maybe. And it might have been rejected.
Maybe. I mean, I think it was a lot meatier than that lame old Sam Smith thing that was the...
The writing's on the wall.
Or the Billie Eilish.
Well, you know what? Yeah. I decided not to pick on Billie this week.
Well, that's okay.
No, you're welcome to.
I didn't decide.
Oh, and I'll be, I know. And it's, I understand that. Well, you know what, Dave? The crowd loves when you're funny like that. You're going to have to tell them to hush now.
Yeah, keep it up. Yeah, I like it. I like it.
They love you, man.
A little
man.
Bit more.
They
bit
love
more.
You. It's hard, right, it's hard to fit Dave's whole family here in the studio. I decided I'll give Billie a pass for a week. Now, next week, I'll be back with plenty of parody and excerpts of her favorite song, as it were. But speaking of artists who have stuff in the vaults or the can or whatever you want to call it, and you don't know, especially if they've died, there's stuff that I've shared with you many times. There is a song that I wrote that I'm told by reliable sources for many years, I was told this, Frank Sinatra recorded, and it's somewhere in vault land, but I can't, and I've tried, I periodically try to track it down again and again, so I probably will never see
it. Which song was it? Do you remember?
Yeah, I remember exactly what it was. It was a song called The Bijou Isn't Open Anymore. And it was kind of a Billy Joel meets Elton John meets me, Randy Newman meets me kind of thing about the old days.
Yeah.
The theater is not here anymore, and kind of a nostalgia look back. But we talk about dead artists and their stuff showing up after years of checking the vaults and whatever, but this is a live person, and this is very exciting because I stumbled across this just a couple of days ago, and you may have seen this depending on where you go on Facebook. I don't know if there's an album coming at all, but this is the single that has surfaced, and the groove is happening, talking about grooves. But I'm a word guy, in addition to being a melody lover. And I got to tell you, I'm happy to share this with you because the title just cracks me up. It's very witty, very clever, and it's not going to fit on a 45, so you'll have to download it. The song is called Sometimes I Drum, Sometimes I Rap, Sometimes I Do Stick Tricks, and then Sometimes I Do All Three. Can't you just, aren't your toes tapping? I'm going to tell you what. You want to explain that to me?
Tell
the folk what that's all about.
That's just a live clip from a show this weekend.
Show this weekend?
Mike Hines and the Look. We're Hall of Fame members.
You're driving this damn thing. Yes. You're the drummer.
the thing is, those HHG drums sound phenomenal. And I can't wait to get my Trinity cymbals in the mail today.
This concludes Dave's plug for HHG drums.
Yeah, those were my endorsement plugs. That's just a clip from the show. I have to put up so much, you know, promotional stuff.
Well, a lot of your stuff is on your Facebook page and showing up online too because of what happened. And we talked about this in a previous incarnation on another broadcast.
Another podcast.
But you know, we don't do that anymore. But because we just got worn out. That's all there is to it. For those who have been polite enough to ask, we're not going to get into it, but we're done with that. Okay? It's all over. We're going to start talking about things we know things about. that's what this is. But Dave had a little honor bestowed this week. Tell the folk about that.
Yes, too. We were inducted into the Delaware Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And
he still got the cement on his hands from where he had to put his hands down on the cement.
It was fun. It was a lot of fun. We had to perform. And then also my good buddy Saul Nolf, who I play in a Neil Diamond tribute show with, was inducted as well. And I had the honor of inducting him. And then I played with him And I played with Mike Conner. I played a lot at the, and then I played the finale. I played a lot at the Hall of Fame show. So it was fun. It was a lot of fun.
With the amount of drumming that you do on a regular basis, you should be able to bench press. You should be up to what, like 9 pounds by now, I would think.
No, eight and a half.
Eight and a half?
Yeah, 8.5.
He's just being modest. Well, congratulations again on the Hall of Fame.
Thank you very much.
And, is there going to be an album on a call?
No, I got a title for you.
I'm going to tell you what the title of the album needs to be.
Go ahead.
Cause I love that part of the phrase.
What?
Stick Tricks. That's an album title. That's what I'm saying.
The thing that's really cool is I do believe that they had a group of people filming the entire ceremony. So I believe at some point in time, it's going to show up somewhere. George and Paula that put on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Basically said that they think, George said maybe WHYY that might run it on there.
Okay.
You know, purchase time and run it on there.
That's whatever. PBS, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you and Ken Burns in competition with
Hey, guy. You know what? You know, I'll kick Ken's ass an evening.
How cool is that? Well, good for you. All right. So we talked about birthdays and inevitably we're going to do a few birthdays and we won't belabor the point each week, but it's just fun to share that information and celebrate a little. But in fairness, we have to kind of say so long to those who have what we call shuffled off the coil. Briefly, Loretta Lynn passed away this past week, 90 years
old. Coal miner's daughter.
And stereotyping, though it may be, those who knew and loved the work, the pure country of those days and everything that she did, this lady's iconic. That's as simple as it is. She was a groundbreaker. She was a traditionalist. She was an innovator. She had a country song hit called The Pill back in the 1960s that was about getting the birth control pill. And you got to remember, this was a Nashville-based country singer, parentheses, if there had been red caps in those days, they would have worn three at a time. That's how conservative that whole audience was. And yet there she was singing about the pill and this guy needs to get off of me because I'm tired of having babies every 20 minutes. It was innovative.
I tell you what, she was also very forward thinking, especially later in her life when she was, you know, kind of considered a has-been. Mm-hmm. She started working with Jack White of the White Stripes fame. And they did an album together that was really good.
Similar to what Johnny Cash did with Rick Rubin.
Trent Reznor and Rick Rubin.
Yeah. Same thing. So, bless, 90. And this is a little left of field, but you'll understand why in a second. Angela Lansbury died this past week, the actress. She was 96.
Murder, She Wrote.
That's right. And I said, among many other things, wait for this. I said a few minutes ago, if you remember, if you were paying attention and made notes, and if not, what's the matter with you? I said, remember the number 96, because it would key in later. Well, here we are. Chuck Berry would have been 96. He didn't make it. Angela Lansbury was 96. Loretta Lynn was 90. I would like to thank them for their contributions to culture, to society, for being graceful, gracious, great ladies in our life and in our history. But more than that, or at least as much as that, thank you so much for living that long so that at least for a little while I can harbor the illusion that every time I pick up the paper or go online that a celebrity's dead, they're not 70 or 71 years old. You guys made it into your 90s and you've done it for me. Thank you. Thank you so much. I was starting to get a little on the paranoid side. And those of you who know me or of us know why I'm saying every damn time I turn around, somebody famous is dying or dropping dead, and they're 70 or 71 years old. So thanks very much. Now, very quickly, why include Angela Lansbury in a program about music? A lot of her accomplishment was on Broadway. She was a multiple Tony Award-winning musical comedy star for years. Lots of shows. Yeah, she did the movies like Bedknobs and Broomsticks, the Disney things. She was the TV lady, the crime lady, the female Columbo kind of sort of.
Murder, She Wrote.
And Murder, She Wrote for many years. But she was a very accomplished musical, as I said, musical actress. Quick example, I believe it was the first production back in the 60s even, or at least early 70s, the very first Broadway production of, and there have been tons of them since then, the Stephen Sondheim musical, Sweeney Todd. Neiman Barber of Fleet Street. And Angela Lansbury in that first Broadway incarnation was that worst pies in London lady, Mrs. Lovett.
Customer! Wait, what you rush, what you hurry? You gave me such a fright, I thought you was a ghost half a minute. Can't you sit? Sit you down, sit. All I meant is that I haven't seen a customer for weeks. Did you come in for a pie, sir? Do forgive me if we had a little bake. What is that? But you think we are the plague? From the way that people keep avoiding, no, you don't have another crisis. But there's no one comes in even to inhale. Right, you are, so would you like a drop of ale? Mind you, I can't hardly blame them. These are probably the worst pies in London. I know why nobody cares to take them. I should know I'd make them, but good, no, the worst pies in London. Even that's polite.
You know, she deserves like a Pulitzer Prize, not only for being as successful as she was as a writer, but she was also the person, and that, if you think for a single second that doing anything, but especially those pieces by Stephen Sondheim, that was like an Olympic-style skill you had to have to be able to sing those things.
Keeping your breath.
Yeah. And night after night and two on Sunday for all the years that they did, but that's what she did. Now, there's one more, real quick, there's one more name on the list of So Long Farewells, Lady Who Passed Away. But interestingly enough, it kind of dovetails, segues into something else, and here's how this is going to work. Along with everything else that we've shared with you this episode and kind of stuff that we think like, yeah, we'll probably do a little something like this every week. One of the things I think we will do every week is Dave and I know people. We know lots of people. We know lots of famous people. Why? Because we've been alive collectively for about 700 years. We've been in show business such as it is for at least 600 of those 700 years.
Yes.
We know some people. And we're not, I tell you what, we are not ashamed to mention it. We're not ashamed to cash in on it. We're not ashamed to drop those names every chance we get and every way we can. And I thought it would be fun. The production staff also agreed it would be fun if we did some kind of version of that each week, a little anecdote, a personal sharing, a story. Well, we don't have one like that prepared this week, so much so, because this is, if you haven't figured this out already, this is kind of the shakedown cruise for the show. But when I came across this name, and I thought, well, I'd like to mention her in passing, and then I realized, you know what? She fits into two categories. One, we say, so long, farewell, thanks for the contribution, but also by way of kind of introducing this segment, I think we'll do every week for sure, and Dave's going to have fun with it too, and that brings me slowly but surely around to this. It's time for this week's episode of Name Droppers.
In a world filled with the famous, the near famous, the wannabe famous, the formerly but still sadly hopeful for a comeback famous, we know them all. From A for Aunt B.
I ain't lazy, Gomer.
To Z for Warren Zevon.
They're dead. They're all dead.
Yeah, we know that.
There's not a celebrity who doesn't answer the phone when we call and say,
who are you?
Who is this?
Who are those guys?
We are the Name Droppers. Name Droppers. Name Droppers.
That's right. And this name drop, here you go. If you listen to any of my podcasts, and I'm sure along the podcast stuff that Dave and I've been doing for the past 4 to 5 years, you've heard me at some point mention that there was a brief period in the 1980s where I lived with Roy Orbison. I'm not going there today. What I want to share with you is Anita Kerr passed away this past week. Dave is nodding like he knows who Anita Kerr is.
I know of her work.
Well, I don't meet her personally either. Yeah. And she was 96, no, 94. All right, another 90s. Way to go, lady. Anita Kerr Singers. Do the Google. You'll find it fascinating. She was the leader, the creator of the Anita Kerr Singers. Back in the 50s, even the 40s, I think, 50s and 60s, there were groups put together whose sole function and profession was to go around and be hired to sing backup on...
Hired guns, yeah.
Recording, yeah. The Jordanaires, who were with Elvis for a lot of his...
And what were the three girls, the black girls with Elvis?
Yeah.
You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
The name eludes me. The Iquettes, but that's kind of live performance. The Anita Kerr Singers were on a number of songs, 50s, 60s, into the 70s, maybe kind of 80s. Mostly Nashville stuff, because she was based in Nashville, but it was not... the pure country kind of stuff. It was more the country-politan things. And by that, I mean easy-listening country. Loretta Lynn was pure country. You didn't hear the Anita Kerr Singers on Loretta Lynn records. But Jim Reeves, Welcome to My World.
Did they win a Grammy for that?
I think so.
Yeah, I think
do the Google or the Wiki. Yeah. You can find that out. Patsy Cline, they were on Patsy Cline records. But it wasn't that they weren't without hip. And that actually takes me around to the old name dropper, because here I go. The Anita Kerr Singers did some work with Roy Orbison. And I thought to myself, I'd like to share an example, but it's hard with background singing to find something that you can say, well, this, and trust me, it's them. And you hear them going, who in the background? And then I went,
I remember because I just did. This is the Anita Kerr Singers from the get-go on a iconic Roy Orbison song, singing what arrangement Anita Kerr provided for Roy in terms of the backup to this legendary tune.
Dum, 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 dum. Only the lonely know the way I feel tonight. If your lonely heart breaks, only the lonely.
How mellow is that?
That was smooth.
There you go. And I wasn't on that recording, but that was 1961. I was only 10 and living somewhere else, so they probably wouldn't have hired me for the
I wasn't born yet.
But check out Anita Kerr. It's kind of an interesting saga story as far as it goes. Well, golly gosh, look where we are.
Two guys who know tunes. Talking tunes. The Audiophiles.
And now, the grand finale.
So that's it? Gone? Boo-hoo?
You know, I got nothing, and I'll tell you, Dave has a thing that I gave him a little prep sheet of where we were going. I did, if you had something on it and want to talk about it, we can for a minute or two.
The Sun City
I passed on that just for time, because I realized it. So we jumped on and then did the birthday thing. But we can actually insert it next week if you'd like to.
Yeah, we can insert it next week. I didn't know that much. I just looked it up. I remember the song, the Sun City song, but.
Yeah. It was one of those charity group things put together like We Are the World and Sun City.
It was like We Are the World, but they added rappers.
Yeah, and again, the segment in itself is lovely, and well, I think you'll enjoy it. But the producer of the program here, who's running the board, said, you know, we need to jump.
Hey, we'll
the
pass
time.
On that.
So, we'll put it in the next week's show.
Yeah,
there's something to look forward to. So, as far as grand finale is concerned,
No,
pretty much. You got anything else?
Nothing for you.
You want to plug upcoming dates or?
Thursday morning we are opening the Ocean City Sun Festival at 10 a.m. in Ocean City, Maryland.
Okay.
And
tickets on sale.
Saturday, we're somewhere.
How much do they charge to get into that thing? Or is it just one of those you show up?
It might be just free.
Street fair style?
Yeah, it's at the end of the boardwalk in Ocean City, right down there. You can't go any farther, you're in the water.
And the brand of drums is what?
HHG drums, Trinity cymbals, yes.
Okay. And I should make mention. And in fact, you know what? Let me tell you how cool the drums are. Before we got on here, I was down in the break room and I bumped into Miley Cyrus, who was looking for some donuts. And I said, hey, have you heard that Dave is using Trinity cymbals? Not Trinity cymbals.
Trinity cymbals.
Trinity cymbals and HHG drums. And she said,
Predicle!
Ah, so that's gonna be really good. All right. If you got nothing, I got nothing. We'll be back next week somewhere around the same time. So, and by the way, don't forget the other cast that will be available for your downloading, Dining and Dancing Pleasure is called the Audio Files, not the audio files. You see, it's so damn clever, I tell you. And that'll be available each week when the program is, and it's kind of cool. I may listen to it myself because
there you go.
Talk about an eclectic group of songs. If you have suggestions, we're in a situation where, as I mentioned, we're not going to take live calls for your birthday, so don't be doing that. All right, plus, okay. We will be, once we shake down the rest of this stuff, probably in a show or two, start doing some solicitation and maybe some folks showing up on the phone from time to time that we talk to that actually have like celebrity value as opposed to us who only are tax people and, you know, ex-relationships. No, but there's that as well. And it seemed like there was something else I need to mention, but I'll think of it. Oh, and again, Revolver, the whole big package. If it's not past October 28th, save the date. It will be available on October 28th. A wonderful opportunity for you to see the evolution of each and every song.
Mm-hmm.
37 takes.
If you enjoyed some of the other Beatle releases.
There you go.
You know, I would pick it up.
Yeah, it's like an oral. A-U-R-A-L, it's like an oral history of being able to see, or a blueprints, or call it whatever you will. And I'll bet, I wish we got paid for everything we hyped and bumped to get these extra sales. We should probably make a call and see what we can do.
hey, it's worth a try.
All right. In the meantime, as Roy and Dale used to say, happy trails to you till we meet again. I'm Scott Edward Phelps.
I'm Dave Simmons.
And we are the Audiophiles.
Audiophiles.